You're listening to Juno Afternoon. I'm Andy Klein. Not everyone can say that they've had a relationship with a wolf, let alone write a book about it. But when Nick Jans wrote A Wolf Called Romeo, he wanted to tell the story of not just any wolf, but one that Juno skiers and hikers came to know and love. Nick is giving a fireside lecture tonight, and that you can watch online and hear why this February is basically turning out to be Romeo Month, a month-long celebration of Romeo through music, art, and this lecture that's going to kick it off. Nick, thanks so much for joining us. Nick, you're down in Florida today. Appreciate you zooming in with us.
Yeah, well, I was supposed to be there, but it was one of those things that mean old Mr. Virus just kind of dictates to you.
That's right. Well, Nick, I remember Romeo so well, had some really amazing experiences with him, just seeing him from a distance there on Mendenhall Lake, taking my dog, making sure I was keeping my dog on a leash, even though she was very interested in Romeo. But I think that we might be getting to the point where there's a lot of people that don't remember a firsthand experience with Romeo. And I'm wondering what your perspective is there as you're going to give a fireside lecture talk about that tonight.
Well, you know, that's the thing, is that history has a way of creeping up on you. You know, that's something that seems like something that was every day. I mean, to my mom and dad, World War II was something they went through.
That's right. Yeah.
And to us, it's in somewhere way back in the rearview mirror, let alone Vietnam, you know. And something like this wolf was such a unique experience. It was pretty much unheard of. I mean, it's one of the great wild animal human interactions of all recorded history. You know, really, I mean, that sounds pretty hyperbolic, but if you leave out the stuff that isn't documented, there just isn't a case of a wolf and a community being on good terms with each other.
It was quite amazing, and it was the talk of the town when it was happening. Remind us the period of time this was happening. How many years was it, and from what year to what year about?
It's hard to believe, but it was 2003 to 2008. So that means it was 18 years since we first saw that wolf.
Wow, yeah.
Give or take.
And just a five-year period when that phenomena was happening.
Actually, it's about six. Mm-hmm. And some people say it's a little bit longer, because there was a time when there were rumors circulating about a wolf out by the glacier and down in the wetlands and so on. But it started getting nailed down in November of 2003, October, November 2003, and as the lake froze, he started appearing more and more out on the lake.
Yeah, now it was a winter phenomena, right? That's how I remember it.
It was for most people, but the wolf came down and used the wetlands areas there surrounding the lake when it was frozen. And of course, when it's all boggy, he was still around some of the time. And he definitely went up into the high country a little more. But there were people like, for instance, Harry Robinson, who will tell you that he had contact with that wolf during the summer and into the fall. And most people just saw him when he came down the lake. And he would disappear even during the winter, sometimes for days, weeks, or even more at a time. And every time he was gone, I thought, well, there he's gone, just going back to being a wolf. Or I'd think terrible thoughts about what might have happened to him. And then he appeared again, mm-hmm. and he kept coming back, and he kept coming back, and he kept rising from the dead,
yeah,
as it were.
Let's recap a little bit some of the, you know, what are the reasonings, what are some of the theories about why he appeared in the first place, why he was there alone, and then kind of the ideas behind why the relationship between the community and him progressed.
Okay, well, first part is that we will never know how exactly that wolf came to be. But there are a number of people who have said things with great certainty that they can't be really certain about. But we do know this, is that a female pregnant black wolf got hit by a taxi out in Back Loop Road in 2003. And he stopped and he heard wolves howling. It was out near the bridge. And he heard wolves howling, and it was thereafter that this one wolf appeared. And some people say that he was her mate. I don't really buy that. I think he
it's was certainly a romantic notion, isn't it? And to
sure,
think that,
and it could
yeah.
have it could have been, but he was a young guy, and not too many adolescent wolves have a wife and family any more than too many 16-year-olds do. Sure, it's biologically possible. So anyway, that's one possibility. But one thing I think is that very, very likely is that he was a sibling or some sort of a relative of that pack. And for whatever reason, the others moved off, the survivors moved off, and he decided to stay around. That much is pretty much, you know, I would say he was connected to that female wolf. But the reason for people kind of getting attached to him, who knows? Okay.
A wolf acting in that way, tolerating people,
sure.
The curiosity. Usually wolves, of course, are so much wanting to get away from where people are.
Yeah. Usually all you see is this furry butthole
right.
disappearing up over the hill. You know, if you catch a glimpse of a wolf,
right.
it's going away fast.
Yeah.
And it was, at first, people were pretty tenuous, and it was a pretty well-kept secret out there among a few, and everyone thought they were keeping a secret from everybody else.
Right.
They said, hey, I got something to tell you. There's a wolf out there. I said, oh, shit, I was going to tell you. And it went from there. So he grew, though, into being quite a celebrity, because once you have a 100-and-some-odd-pound black wolf out on an open lake wanting to socialize with people's dogs, and that's what he came for, is he came for our dogs. He wanted social contact, and that put him in touch with us, inevitably. And that's what I think is really remarkable about this story, is that it traces that conflicted, convoluted relationship between man's best friend, man's greatest fear, and us.
Yeah.
And that connection.
Is that what drew you to the story? What was it that drew you to the point where you actually wrote a book about it and really began studying this? And what was it that brought you in?
Well, first of all, I was a firsthand direct participant in the whole thing. The name Romeo came from my wife, Sherry. I mean, I lived out by the glacier, the last house there before Skater's Cabin. I built it and didn't know that I was doing that, so I would meet this wolf. And I came to Alaska in 1979 to be a wolf and bear biologist. I didn't end up doing that. I ended up living in Inupiaq villages in the far north and traveling with Inupiaq hunters and seeing wolves on my own out in the surrounding country. By the time I came south, got married to Sherry, I'd encountered many dozens of wolves. I can't even count them, singly, in pairs, in great packs, from a distance, close up. And I thought I was leaving that all behind. I came down to Juneau. Oh, I'm living with Fred Meyer up the road. And oh, there's a road. And lo and behold, there's a wolf literally at my doorstep. You know, the old saying, a wolf at the door, was a literal thing for 6 years on and off of my life out there. And so I had a direct personal engagement. He was waiting out there for our dogs, and you know, to come out and do what they had to do sooner or later, because he wanted to socialize. And my wife Sherry gave him the name Romeo because he seemed so attracted to our beautiful yellow lab, Dakota. And of course, that's her picture on the book cover there. But he had relationships with a number of dogs. And it was just the way that you and I have friendships and relationships. Some are closer, some are less close. Some people we're really drawn to, and we don't know exactly why. Sometimes we do, but there certainly was all variations, including where he had frenemies and even enemies among dogs.
So there was observed different behaviors with different specific individual dogs. Is that right?
Oh, yeah. I mean, there were dogs that irked him. There were dogs that attacked him. I think of these two large German Shepherd dogs that he was having social contact with. And one of them suddenly turned on him and grabbed him by the back. And he was totally caught by surprise. And he had a wound on his back that was very visible for a year there, and then a scar after that. And that was from him being attacked. And he did nothing to those dogs. He had everything from dogs, like for instance, my neighbors, Tim and Maureen Hall's rabbity little border collie named Jessie. She'd run off this little, 25-pound dog and disappear with this wolf and be gone, for hours and hours, and would come back,
Yeah.
And I saw a big chunky golden retriever talking some smack to him once, and Romeo hooked his nose underneath that dog's chin and just gave a toss of his head, and that dog did a flip in the air and came down on his keister, and he just looked at the dog, stood over it, and walked off.
Well, I mean, it is amazing, and one of the things I remember so distinctly seeing Romeo was, there's no mistaking a wolf. I mean, it's not like, oh, there's a dog. There's nothing like that. They're massive, intimidating, tall, lanky. They're a whole other type of creature than those of us that might think, oh, I was scared. I saw a German Shepherd on the trail and I thought it was a wolf.
Right. Right.
It's a whole other thing.
Absolutely. It's like mistaking a Shetland pony for Seabiscuit, It's kind of the same general shape and everything, but no. A wolf is an uber dog. It's bigger, faster, stronger, smarter, everything in this package. And then we get a hold of that wolf, that wolf genome, that lupine genome. And what do? We dumb it down. We make it smaller and easier to handle, and fool it into thinking that it's got a good deal with us, which actually
it probably does.
Well, actually it does.
Yeah.
Actually it does. And not to make light of anything, because I'm very much a dog lover, but you have to remember that even a teacup chihuahua is 90-something% genetically identical to a wolf. And it's really amazing that we started off with wolves and we ended up with what we have. But Romeo is sort of that link between those two. And he is just a single example. The wolf that came to lie by our fire must not have happened once, but many times throughout human history for us to have this great arising of dogs all over. Wherever we were, we had dogs going back 30,000 plus years, and that is part of the archaeological record.
Yeah, it's fascinating to think about that. And did the interactions between Romeo that you observed or were part of, did it give you a hint about that a little bit, about those first things that we'll probably never quite know fully, but how dogs became part of our lives?
Well, it more impressed on me over and over again the miracle that it happened at all. I mean, this is one of the probably the single most unique bond between two different species on the planet. And by the way, you have to remember that dogs and wolves are technically the same species according to North American Society of Mammalogists.
Yeah, they can
different branches and, for
yeah,
sure.
Right.
Yeah. They can have viable offspring. So, of course, they're the same species technically. And somehow we have this alliance. And I think there always was this thing between wolves and us as apex predators. And yet at the same time, we saw them as obviously as competition, because ever since the rise of civilization, we've been in the business of killing off wolves. We're talking about worldwide. And you can say, oh, no, well, you know, I love wolves and that. Now, if you just look at the whole thing, every place you put up a parking lot or a road or a farm field, there isn't space, or certainly not a pasture full of sheep. There is no space there for a wolf.
And certainly wolves have been vilified as, you know, the bad guy in countless fables and stories throughout human history. So, yeah, you're right. There's a long, obviously a long history of us. While we did domesticate wolves and they're partners with us, and probably in the early stages, they weren't very different than wild wolves. They just had gotten used to us. We definitely also have this, well, it's a love-hate relationship, and that sort of goes down to this idea of Romeo. You know, one thing I wanted to ask you, Nick, is that your book, A Wolf Called Romeo, is going to be used in the Battle of the Book competition in Juneau. What do you think about this, that's an important book for maybe younger people to be reading?
Well, I'm just incredibly honored that it was chosen, first of all. But I'm going to be doing a couple of programs, again, from a distance instead of in person, as they're meant to be, coming up this next week on Monday at Juneau Douglas High School via Zoom. I realized that those kids, if they were 15 years old, they were yeah, toddlers at best.
Right.
And I'll probably be talking to some kids who weren't even born yet, or right around that time, or were maybe six years old, 5 years old. And this is part of Juno's story. And it's an incredible part of Juno's story. And you think about the fact that here we are having this series of events, which, by the way, I have to say is all due to composer Todd Hunt. It is totally his deal. He started this ball rolling, and that in itself is just so cool. And it's such an honor to Romeo's memory that he is still alive among us. You can go out to the glacier, and there is that bronze plaque on the way to the waterfall, and there he is. And yeah, you know, I know it's taxidermy, but it's what we had left of him. And there he is inside the visitor center.
Yeah, and that's something actually to cover that maybe people aren't aware of, but Romeo is there. That is Romeo. That is what we had left of him to recover, that's there in the visitor center.
Yeah, and not only that, that's one of the stories that tour bus operators and people on cruise ships, me included, tell people from somewhere else, because it is such a quintessential Alaska story. This is all about what people think should happen in Alaska. And one of the first things I have to do is offer them a disclaimer is, no, this sort of thing doesn't happen, not even in Alaska. And yet it did.
It just happened this one time that we know of. Yeah. Well, Nick, before I let you go, let's make sure we plug the lecture tonight. It's the Fireside Lecture. It's happening at 7 p.m. And of course, usually these are at the visitor center at the Mendenhall Glacier, but because of COVID, which hopefully is starting to wane again, it's been moved to online, which is great. You know, it'll be a way for lots of people to be able to view it and view it just by going to Zoom. So tell me, what are you hoping to cover there, just real briefly?
Well, it's going to be a slideshow basically covering the story of Romeo, because it's something that if I don't get tired of it, I think no one else will. But the important thing to know is what you need to do is to go to the Mendenhall Glacier Visitor Center Facebook page, and it's going to be streaming on Facebook. It will also be saved there. If you have a birthday party to go to, like my friend Dr. Vic Walker, who told me he can't go because he's going to a birthday party.
Oh, call out.
You can save it for later.
Yeah, that's great. And actually, we were talking to cartographers that were on last week, and I tuned in for a while on Facebook, and it was great. It worked really slick. Everything was really awesome. So in some ways, it's an accessible way for people to make sure they see these lecture series that are always sellouts when they're in person.
Sure.
And And it'll be a great way for people to hear about the story and to relive it. And for those of us who weren't here in Juneau or who weren't even born yet, maybe, to learn about it. Nick, thanks so much. Really appreciate it. Great to talk to you. Anything else you want to cover real quick before we let you go?
Yeah. Just a couple last plugs. Let's remember that tomorrow at the campground, there's going to be the Romeo Trot ski event.
We're going to talk about that next. We've got them
online.
Right. They're
That's coming up next.
No, yep.
So I'm not going to get into that. But also, of course, is the big main event, the Wolf Music that's going to happen at Juneau Douglas High School. And that will be on the 18th and 19th plus at 7:30 p.m. plus a Sunday matinee at 3 p.m. on the 20th. Okay, so that's going to be a huge deal.
Really cool,
I'm really going to miss not seeing that live. That's what I wanted to come up for.
We're really looking forward to that, and we've been playing public service announcements about that. In fact, just played one right before we joined you. So, we've got a lot of the Romeo month. Yeah, go ahead. Yeah.
Oh, it is, of course, the photo exhibit down at the Jack, and also those photos that are only there to see, but you can bid on them and take them home with you. And there are also a limited edition of photo books that are available for purchase. And all of this helps fund the Orpheus Project, of which Todd Hunt is the linchpin, along with Dr. Emily Kane. And I also want to recognize Matthew Brown and Carrie Howard for all the work they did on this project to make this happen.
All right. Well, Nick, thanks for covering all that. The Jack that's got the photographs, the amazing music that's going to be happening a little bit later this month. And we're not done with Romeo just yet, because right after this, we're going to be talking to how cross-country skiers plan to remember Romeo. And that's going to be happening right when we come back. Nick Jans, thanks so much. It was great seeing you here. I get to see you here in person in the studio, but great to talk to you as well. And thanks so much for joining us. Appreciate it.
Thanks a lot, Andy.
Okay.
Bye.